From Michigan Radio, it's Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we'll hear about secret Great Lakes water diversions in Wisconsin.
That made Pleasant Prairie the largest water diversion in Wisconsin, and nobody knew about it.
We'll also talk to a pipeline safety expert about Enbridge Line 5 and where the money would come from to clean up an oil spill, and whether you actually can clean up a spill.
History shows you just don't recover a large segment of the oil. You get a piece of it, but not a lot, and so that could be a problem.
It's the 50th anniversary of 2001 A Space Odyssey, with a special screening of the film and a live performance of the music.
And it has a very interesting mix of artistry, both visually and through music, but also predicting with eerie accuracy the future of technology.
Plus, we'll tell you how to make a pawpaw colada. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. As part of expanded coverage by the Environment Report, Stateside will be looking at environmental issues more frequently. And today we're going to talk about diverting water from the Great Lakes. A revised and updated book titled The Great Lakes Water Wars has revealed a large diversion that might have violated agreements between the Great Lakes states and two provinces of Canada along the lakes. Peter Annan is the author of the book, and he joins us now. Hey, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, Lester.
So let's start with some basics. What kind of agreement or agreements limit water withdrawals from the Great Lakes?
Well, the main one is the Great Lakes Compact, which I like to think of as a legal water fence that surrounds the Great Lakes watershed and is designed to keep Great Lakes water inside the Great Lakes basin. It really was implemented because of a fear that in an era of increasing global and continental water insecurity, that there could be a run on the Great Lakes with long-range, large-scale water diversions.
Now, I want you to define Great Lakes Basin. When you say that, what does that mean?
When you think about the Great Lakes, all of them together, they're surrounded by what I refer to as a soup bowl rim, or high ground. And water, rainfall, snowfall, groundwater recharge that occurs within that soup bowl is the secret to water sustainability in the Great Lakes region. And water that falls outside that soup bowl rim flows into the Mississippi River to the west, or the Hudson Bay watershed to the north, or the Atlantic Ocean watershed to the east.
I recall a couple of years ago there was a lot of discussion about whether the Wisconsin city of Waukesha could withdraw water from Lake Michigan because its water supply was contaminated by radium. It was right on the edge of that basin. How was that handled?
Yeah, and so under the Great Lakes Compact, you know, which is a ban on diversions with limited exceptions, there are two complicated limited exceptions. One is for straddling communities that sit right on top of the edge of the soup bowl rim, and the other one is for straddling counties that have communities that are in a county that straddles the soup bowl rim, but the towns itself in question are outside, clean and clear outside the Great Lakes Basin. And Waukesha was in a straddling county situation under the Great Lakes Compact, and its water diversion proposal required the approval of all 8 Great Lakes governors, not just the local governor of Wisconsin, but all 8 Great Lakes governors from New York to Minnesota. And it was quite a controversial water diversion proposal.
And finally, I think public health won out on that because the people were, they had contaminated water. So that, I'm sure, influenced. But in its bid to win Foxconn Technology Group Factory, Wisconsin again needed water from Lake Michigan. Now, this wasn't for public health reasons. Why was it okay to have that withdrawal?
Foxconn is just as controversial, if not more, in some circles than Waukesha. And Foxconn is an application. The other one that I referred to falls under the straddling community application exception of the Great Lakes Compact. And those applications, because the communities sit half in or part out of the Great Lakes watershed, the compact negotiators decided that only the local governor needed to approve those straddling community applications. They notify the other Great Lakes states and provinces. They can take feedback from them, have feedback from the general public through a public hearing process. But in the end, after all of that, the local governor alone is the one who decides these straddling community water diversion applications and Wisconsin approved the Foxconn diversion earlier this year, and it's now being litigated.
In your revised book that's just come out, The Great Lakes Water Wars, you reveal the state of Wisconsin okayed another diversion, an even larger one, for a city that had been the source of quite a bit of negotiation and debate before. Let's talk about Pleasant Prairie and its first request for a water diversion before the Great Lakes Compact was in place. When was that and what happened?
Yeah, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, Pleasant Prairie, again, in that same part of Wisconsin, it has bad groundwater, applied for a water diversion from the Great Lakes because its groundwater was just abysmal. I mean, it looked bad, it smelled bad, and the only thing people mainly use it for was flushing the toilet. This was very early on in the whole water diversion debate in the Great Lakes region, and Pleasant Prairie, after a long, drawn-out struggle, was granted a water diversion of 3.2 million gallons per day, again, back in the late 1980s, early 1990s.
And at the time, as your book explains, Governor Blanchard had some serious questions about it, but finally said, okay, fine. It was capped at a certain amount of water per day. But since then, recently, Pleasant Prairie has been given permission by the Wisconsin state government to take a lot more water out of Lake Michigan. On what authority was that granted?
Yeah, and this is the big surprise. It came out of the reporting in my book, and it's gotten a lot of attention. And it's just, under the Great Lakes Compact, which was adopted in 2008, all the Great Lakes states were required to report to the Great Lakes Governors Association where they have existing diversions prior to the compact and what the level of those diversions are so that they could be grandfathered in at a level that could then be used as a baseline from which future expansions of those water diversions in the future might be measured from. Well, Wisconsin, in the grandfathering Pleasant Prairie, boosted Pleasant Prairie's water diversion from 3.2 million gallons per day to 10.69 million gallons per day based on anticipated future need, and so that the sewer system matched up with the water supply system. That made Pleasant Prairie the largest water diversion in Wisconsin, and nobody knew about it. It wasn't publicly notified. There were no public hearings about it, and that was something that I dug up in the reporting on the book, and it's captivated a lot of attention since the book came out.
You also report in the book that a California water bottling company has set up shop in Pleasant Prairie. Seems like instead of piping Great Lakes water away, are we shipping it out of the basin in bottles now?
Bottled water is an extraordinarily controversial and complicated issue. But there is an irony that this community that got permission for a diversion of Great Lakes water now has a California water bottling company that is using water from that diversion to send bottled water hither and yon. Fascinating juxtaposition of events.
Let's bottom line this, and I don't know if you can answer this question, but was this a violation of law? Was this a violation of the compact?
That's the big debate right now, and I think everyone's kind of still digesting what exactly this means. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is quite confident that it followed the letter of the law and that expanding Pleasant Prairie's water diversion does not violate the language of the compact. That's their position. At least one environmental organization is consulting attorneys. That's the Alliance for the Great Lakes in Chicago. And then in the book, as you know, I quote the former head of the water division at the Wisconsin DNR, who is questioning the legality of the Pleasant Prairie move. But there's another debate here, Lester, too, is that there's the letter of the law and there's the spirit of the law. And the Great Lakes Compact was adopted in an incredibly transparent way. The Waukesha diversion also was processed in a very transparent way. And what's shocking a lot of people is you could have this massive 7 million gallon water diversion for a relatively modestly sized community that became the largest water diversion in Wisconsin, and nobody knew. That's what's catching a lot of people off guard. So maybe it's illegal, maybe it's not. The DNR is quite certain that it's not illegal, but there's a lot of conversations going on about the spirit of the compact and whether this meets the spirit of the compact and what was intended by those compact authors.
What you reported in the book has been picked up by the Milwaukee Sentinel, the Chicago Tribune, now here on Michigan Radio. And I'm wondering, are you starting to get some idea about what the other Great Lakes states are saying about this revelation?
yes, I am, confidentially. I'm getting a lot of thank yous and no commitment on where they stand on this, but they're very, very grateful to have been alerted to the situation at this point. So again, a lot of people still kind of digesting the news, and there'll be upcoming meetings of the Great Lakes Compact Council and regional body. There'll be one meeting in Indianapolis on October 3rd and another one in Chicago on December 8th. And I would imagine that this topic will come up.
I'm wondering if that first diversion back in the 80s to Pleasant Prairie and the subsequent Wisconsin diversions have kind of opened a Pandora's box of water withdrawals now.
Basically, what we've seen is that for 100 years, the largest and most controversial diversion in the Great Lakes region has been in Chicago, where we have 2.1 billion gallons of Great Lakes water going to the Gulf of Mexico every day, not being returned. And what we've seen in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s is that Wisconsin has sort of been chipping away with a series of small, medium-sized water diversions that don't even come close to Chicago. And that water is being returned to the Great Lakes after use, which is required by the compact. But there are a lot of them. Wisconsin now has more water diversions than all other Great Lakes states combined. And it has become sort of what I call the new front line in the Great Lakes water war. And I don't think it's necessarily a Pandora's box. I mean, these were the things that the compact anticipated. These water diversions don't set precedent for long-range, large-scale diversions. These were all under the exception clause, and all the water needs to be returned to the Great Lakes Basin after it's used. But I think we're going to see more water diversions in southeastern Wisconsin, and what we have, especially in the state of Michigan, is an incredibly engaged public on these water issues. And I think that needs to continue because, you know, in the end, if the population isn't engaged on this, that's when untoward things tend to happen.
Peter Annan is the director of the Northland College Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation in Wisconsin and the author of the revised and updated book, The Great Lakes Water Wars. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Lester. Thank you.
We reached out to Governor Rick Snyder's office for comment. Tanya Baker, the governor's deputy press secretary, emailed us this statement, quote, "All jurisdictions take compliance with the Great Lakes Compact very seriously. The state is looking back through the record to try to understand the history as well as reviewing the case to see what the impact of the withdrawal is. If an issue is identified, it will be taken up with the Compact Council," end quote. And Michigan's representative on the Great Lakes Compact Council has agreed to join us on Monday. Tune in to Monday's Stateside to hear that interview. Later in today's show, we'll continue our water coverage and discuss how prepared Enbridge is for a possible Line 5 spill in the Straits of Mackinac. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, it's the weekend. How about a drink?
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings, and we're here for another Cheers episode, and I'm very proud of you because a couple of my colleagues, April Van Buren and Mercedes Mejia, challenged you with making a sort of piña colada, but not using pineapple, instead using pawpaw. And I love that because, you know, it's the Midwest tropical fruit. So why accept that challenge?
I thought it was a great challenge. As soon as I heard the words pawpaw colada, I thought this is a drink that needs to get made.
How difficult is it to make a transition from, you know, a classic standard sugary drink that people love, or at least some people love, and making it out of a fruit that not very many people are familiar with?
Well, pawpaws are very, very sweet, so the sugary side wasn't a problem at all. One of the things that I had to decide first off was I going to replace one of the standard pina colada ingredients with the pawpaw, or was I going to use it as an add-on? In the end, I thought it didn't really work as a drink if it didn't have some of that pineapple juice in there. So this has both pineapple juice and some pawpaw puree.
So not everybody's familiar with pawpaw. What do we know about it?
So it is a native North American fruit, grows up here in the Great Lakes all the way down to the Florida panhandle, and it doesn't taste like what you would think a North American fruit would taste like. It actually tastes really tropical. Sometimes it's been called a Michigan banana because it has this interesting soft texture. Some people actually call it a custard apple. And then it has mango notes, banana notes, some sort of funky, musky kind of flavors. It's really unique, very sweet, but totally a taste of Michigan.
And one of the things that's really interesting about pawpaws is if you get a fairly green, fresh pawpaw versus one that's fully ripe, the taste is much different. And some people prefer it one way, some people prefer it the other way. What did you use in this pawpaw colada?
So we use very, very ripe pawpaw pulp. Unlike other ingredients where you might have to puree them in a blender, the pawpaw, when it's very ripe, is really soft. So it's just a matter of scraping off the pulp from around these big brown seeds that are in the middle of it, and then you've already got a puree that's ready to mix into a drink.
Well, how'd you make the pawpaw colada?
In a blender, I combined 1.5 ounces of rum. I used a dark rum. You could also use a white rum. I used 1 ounce of coconut syrup. So a traditional pina colada recipe calls for cream of coconut, which is a highly processed product. You may have seen it on shelves called Coco Lopez. I like to use something a little homemade, but you could totally substitute Coco Lopez in this recipe. I used 2 ounces of pineapple juice, 2 tablespoons of the pawpaw pulp, 1/4 ounce of lime, because like I said, pawpaw is really sweet, and I wanted to counter that a little bit to make a tastier drink. And then this is going to sound a little weird, but a pinch of salt really amps up all the flavors in the drink. Then I added 1 cup of crushed ice to my blender and let it rip.
So what's it taste like?
Well, you tell me, does this fit your platonic image of a pawpaw colada?
Well, the pawpaw is really present because it's got that unique taste, but it's very, very good. The rum is just a tiny back note to the whole thing, but the pineapple and the pawpaw play together really well.
You completely miss the coconut, and I think that's a really important thing that ties that pineapple and the pawpaw together and gives it that creamy texture that we expect from a pina colada.
Well, I'm glad you took up this challenge. The results are really tasty.
We've been doing these Cheers episodes for a while now, so we're always looking for new ideas.
If you want to make a suggestion, remember, it has to be a Michigan ingredient, and you can send a message through the Stateside webpage, and you can find all of that at michiganradio.org. Cheers.
Cheers.
Love it, hate it. There's no doubt Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey has had a lasting impact. Here it is, 50 years after its 1968 release, and it's still being celebrated.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Tonight, there will be a showing of the film at Hill Auditorium at the University of Michigan. And the music, which is so identified with the film, will be performed by a live orchestral and choral accompaniment. Joining us now is the president of the University Musical Society, Matthew Van Beesen, along with the dean of the University of Michigan College of Engineering, Alec Gallimore. Welcome to both of you. I'm going to start with Alec first. So here's this sci-fi movie with music presented by the University of Michigan. What do we have an engineer in here for? Why are you interested in that film?
Well, it's an inspirational film for many of us who are in the space business, first of all. But it also showed technologies that we take for granted. So, for example, it was actually the first movie that I'm aware of that showed iPads decades before they were invented. And it has a very interesting mix of artistry, both visually and through music, but also predicting with eerie accuracy the future of technology, showing space shuttles, space stations, and things of that nature.
So how old were you when you first saw it?
4 years old, and I remember seeing it live in Washington, D.C.
What kind of impact did it have on you?
Well, it caused me to become the person I am. I guess you can say I'm a rocket scientist, and I developed some of the plasma propulsion technologies that the movie identified would be needed to send astronauts to Jupiter.
When I started talking, I said love it or hate it. And the reason I said hate it is because I read a paper in Participations, the Journal of Audience and Reception Studies, and it reviewed the letters mailed to Kubrick shortly after the film was released. And a lot of people found it incoherent or really disturbing. What was your impression the first time you saw it, Matthew?
Well, I've been a Kubrick fan for a long time. It was not the first film of his that I ever saw. Probably The Shining was. Somehow my parents let me see that when I was a young person. But it's even today, 50 years later, it's incredibly audacious as a film. It's audacious, certainly scientifically, but it's also audacious artistically in the way in which it's constructed. And so, you know, from my vantage point in the film, I mean, this is a work of art that transcends filmmaking. It transcends normal sort of artistic parameters.
That was not a universal feeling, though, at the time. Not all the critics were a big fan.
Well, I think it had very critically mixed reception. And if when you watch the film again, you see those opening sequences of The Dawn of Man, which is the first chapter of the film. And you can just imagine what the MGM studio execs were thinking at the time. I mean, they must have thought, how did we ever allow this person to make this work? Because even today it feels audacious 50 years later. So you can imagine what it would have felt like in 1968.
Well, let's talk about the music, because how important is the music of Johann Strauss, Richard Strauss, George Ligeti to the success of that film?
Well, I mean, Kubrick was first and foremost a filmmaker, and, you know, he started his career as a photographer, I think, for Look magazine. So he came from that photographic background, but he clearly had an interest in all of his films in bringing the musical landscape together with the visual. And so his selections of these works are incredibly important to the final. You know, it's not a heavily dialogue-driven film. In fact, there are long stretches of the film with no dialogue and sometimes even with no sound. And so music for Kubrick was not an incidental element. It was an element that he really wanted to have impact and be part of the overall artistic texture.
From someone with a science and engineering future, how did that music affect you when you were seeing it on the screen?
Well, I mean, the imagery I saw on the screen, looking at the moon base, looking at the space station, looking at the space shuttle, looking at that amazing spacecraft Discovery 1, and with the beautiful music playing with it, it really just transformed the experience for me. It brought me to space, actually. I felt like I was floating around in space. I felt I was on that ship from Earth orbit to the moon. So it really transformed me.
Can I just add one thing about the music, which I think is really important to remember, that the music that's in this film, so you've got the famous Blue Danube waltzes. You have the opening of Alza Sprague's Zarathustra by Richard Strauss. You have 40 minutes of Ligeti, who was at that point a very contemporary, not well-known composer in Europe, writing micropolyphony, which is not just different layers and textures, but actually microtonal.
Well, you're getting exactly to what my next question is.
but I want to make a point that was not the music that was intended to be
right,
in the film.
Right, it was supposed to be, what was his
Alex
name?
Alex North.
Right, because he got kicked off at the last minute of the production of
the film. The urban myth, or maybe a myth, that he didn't discover that his music was not in the film until he was in the theater at the premiere, which must have made for a little bit of discomfort.
So it would appear to this uninformed high school band dropout that Ligeti's pieces are not the easiest to perform, especially for the chorus. Tell me about those works, the two works that are his.
Well, the two works he really draws from is a movement from his Requiem called Lux Aeterna, and then also a piece called Adventures. But they are really predicated on something called micropolyphony. And so you've got multiple layers of harmony on top of one another, but then what Ligeti is doing is also using what's called microtonality. So, you know, we think of do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, but there are obviously frequencies in between those notes, and so Ligeti is using this kind of what we call microtonal music to create a very atmospheric kind of sound. And actually one of his most famous works is coincidentally called Atmosphere. So the Ligeti, you know, everyone remembers the famous music in 2001, but there are 40 minutes of Ligeti, and, you know, it's really, it You know, and he actually didn't know that Kubrick was using this music, and actually there was a settlement later on after the film gained, you know, the huge notoriety that it did. And Ligeti was not necessarily a big Kubrick fan, but Kubrick continued to use Ligeti's music fully licensed in subsequent pictures. But it's an amazing texture that is woven through the film, and you can understand the type of this kind of surreal, especially when in those scenes, he's really looking to build a very specific kind of atmosphere.
Tension, yeah.
Tension, absolutely.
There's an article in The Guardian. Conductor Robert Ziegler wrote, "Kubrick's use of Johann Strauss's waltz, The Beautiful Blue Danube, was a stroke of absolute genius in the way that it was used." When you hear The Blue Danube, what pops into your mind?
The scenes from that movie, without a doubt, the majesty associated with space travel. And engineering is a left brain and a right brain enterprise. And I think some people don't realize the creativity associated with engineering. So many engineers are musicians. And so it's not so alien when you think about it. When you think about a beautiful car or a beautiful piece of technology or even your phone and things like that, there's an element of technology, you know, that's associated with left brain, but there's also a very highly creative aspect of it associated with your right brain.
Of course, we've got to talk about Zarathustra. Why does that work so well with 2001: A Space Odyssey? Because that's the song that first comes to mind for most people regarding that movie.
Sure. I mean, the question I always wonder is, The Blue Danube waltzes were well known prior to this film, but the opening of Zarathustra was not. In fact, you know, it's often referred to now as the opening of 2001 rather than the actual real name of the
piece. It's the theme movie. It's the theme music of the movie. Yeah.
Strauss was at, you know, the height of, Richard Strauss was at the height of his powers, you know, when he wrote this. He was writing a series. He was one of the first composers to really write what we call programmatic music, so music that was specifically trying to depict a story or an aesthetic in a very literal, in a more literal way, musically. Look, it's just an incredible, uncanny opening, and what's really going to be exciting is that there's actually organ in that opening, and more often than not, you're in a concert hall where you have to use what we lovingly call a toaster rather than an organ. You're using an electronic organ.
Right.
But in Hill Auditorium, of course, we have this wonderful historic
pipe organ.
That will make that opening just be thunderous and incredibly high impact. Mm.
This film is a favorite as far as live music performances, I understand. Different outfits have been doing this for a while. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think that obviously music has been an integral part of films. It really hasn't been until the last, I don't know, I want to say like 10 to 20 years where people worked out a way to actually do films, projecting films live and then having the orchestral score to accompany them. And they're often done with what's called a click track, not dissimilar to how they're actually recorded in the studio when the film is in post-production. But this ability to have live performance as part of a film, you know, I remember when we first started in the orchestra business, started doing these, people were like, well, how do you get people to pay more money to actually go and see to go to the movies? But in fact, What's happened is that it really has much more similarity to live performance than it does just showing a film. And in this case, we have the Detroit Symphony coming. We have Musica Sacra, which is one of the really most outstanding contemporary music choruses in New York. We have conductor Robert Ziegler coming. So it's really a complex endeavor. And it goes without saying, but I'll say it for sure, really this could not have happened without the partnership with Michigan Engineering. Alec and I started talking about this, you know, the idea of collaborating between the institutions, and we we hit on this as an early idea, and just his belief in the project and the school's belief in the project and embracing it and using it as a platform to have a whole range of discussions is really inspirational.
Alec, I'm going to give you the last word. I'm wondering, what is the sweet moment you're going to be looking for in the film and with the music?
Well, the opening is just going to be amazing, of course. But I would say the film has so many layers of complexity associated, and it's a wonderment. I look at this as not necessarily a film with live music, but almost a live music playing with imagery that makes you think about some profound ideas. The dawn of intelligence on the human species, extraterrestrial life, the thought of humans being able to evolve to even a more advanced state of being and things of that. And therefore, so you see the transition when primitive pre-human apes had, with the help of aliens, discovered the use of tools in the form of bones. And this creature throws it up, and then millions years forward, it transitions into a spacecraft. I thought it was the most powerful part of the film.
That is, without question, one of the most stunning elements of the film.
That is Matthew Van Beesen, president of the University Musical Society, along with Alec Gallimore, dean of the University of Michigan's College of Engineering. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The film, 2001, A Space Odyssey, will be shown with accompanying live orchestra and chorus at Hill Auditorium tonight at 8 o'clock. The event is free, but you have to sign up. Check out ums.org for more information. Still to come, what the Schuette and Whitmer campaigns are getting right and wrong, and their biggest hurdles between now and November.
I think there's a problem that both candidates are going to have, and that is turnout.
Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Last week, Michigan Radio released an online illustration of just how many support anchors have had to be replaced for the underwater portion of Enbridge's gas and oil pipelines, and it's a bunch. Enbridge Line 5, as you might recall, runs along the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac. That's the body of water connecting Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. The Line 5 is 65 years old, and there's a great deal of concern by people that it might fail spilling crude oil into the Great Lakes. Enbridge, which is a corporate sponsor of Michigan Radio, insists that Line 5 is sound, but it is looking at the idea of constructing an underground tunnel for the twin pipelines. Joining me now is a pipeline safety expert. Richard Kuperwitz is the president of the company AccuFacts Incorporated. Welcome to the program.
How you doing?
I'm fine. There have been some computer-modeled simulations of worst-case scenarios if there was a leak in Line 5, and they all look pretty bad. One estimate is that it would cost as much as $2 billion in cleanup costs. How accurate do you think that estimate might be?
Well, I used to think $1 billion was a lot of money, but nowadays in real sensitive environments, that number is probably not very far off.
Some reports out of Minnesota and Wisconsin find Enbridge does not have enough insurance to cover a spill of another pipeline that Enbridge operates. Does Enbridge have enough insurance to cover the cost of a crude oil spill or leak of Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac?
I don't really know the details there. Many companies will self-insure to a certain limit, and it depends on the size of the company. And then they'll kick over into like a Superfund consortium. You know, a bunch of insurance companies might band together and take it, so they kind of mitigate, spread the risk around. But they're, you know, if you've got risk in certain areas that are so expensive, the premiums can get so high, you got to ask why you'd even do business.
So Enbridge is following the same kind of insurance pattern most of the other pipeline companies.
Yeah, the same, very similar business model. I'd say it'd be difficult for them to handle it by themselves.
To handle a Line 5 spill.
Yes. Now, they did handle, to a large extent, the Marshall, Michigan and Dilbert spill.
Sure, the Kalamazoo River spill, yeah.
Yep, mm-hmm.
They paid all of that out of pocket.
I don't know that for a fact. I lose track of some of these things after a while, and so my background or my information might be a little outdated.
But as the best of your memory, they paid for it.
Well, they paid at least a big chunk, and that, you know, that number went well past $1 billion.
If there were a big spill in the Straits of Mackinac, how long would it take to get the equipment and personnel in place to deal with a leak?
Well, and this is what's disturbing. I know they've looked at spill response scenarios and various staging, and they probably have a lot of equipment staged in various parts where they could respond fairly quickly. But the problem is the law of Murphy may kick in here. Line 5 also moves propane. And so the law of Murphy says your worst-case scenario would be the line, you know, splits open or breaks, ruptures, and it's got a batch of propane along with it. And, you know, releasing propane in the area, it would prevent the emergency responders, the oil spill response crews, from getting into the site and recovering for quite a while. And so that's something that when people look at the spill response, would you be able to get access to the site? And you may not for a while, which means it could really spread.
What kind of resources does it take to clean up a large spill? I mean, remember the Gulf of Mexico, I think Kalamazoo River was different because it's confined to a river.
The Kalamazoo was different. It had bilge and it sank. Most conventional oils float when they hit water. And a lot of the oil in the Gulf, Macondo well, it was more conventional oil, so it tends to float, which means traditional ways of oil spill response for conventional oil is you contain, boom, and try to recover, skim, and recover before it hits the shores or gets too far along the sensitive waterways. And even then, you know, history shows you just don't recover a large segment of the oil. You get a piece of it, but not a lot, and so that could be a problem. So the first rule in oil spill response, and I'm not trying to make light of this, is don't spill the oil. And the second rule is if you violate the first rule, have equipment and staging and a plan that will actually work and where you're reasonably effective. And so they may look at the conventional way of dealing with this, and if it doesn't have propane, their plan may be very well, likely to be successful. But if it's got the propane, you know, and again, as I mentioned, law of Murphy tends to align these scenarios in the worst cases, you're not going to be able to use conventional methods for quite a while.
Enbridge has said these worst-case scenarios are flawed, that any spill could be shut off pretty quickly because they could shut down the flow through the line in no time. What do you think of that?
Well, I know more about that area. I'm one of the few people who have actually, you know, looked at the submerged pipelines crossing the straits. I think they actually believe they can do that, and if they get notification, there's no doubt that they could shut the system in fairly quickly and limit the size of the oil spill. But they'll have to really look that over to be sure that what they think they can do, they can actually do in a, again, Murphy may align that it's winter time, the winds are blowing like crazy, that area has currents like you can't believe. And so they may have thought this through. I think if they've got a good plan, they ought to be able to demonstrate that. But it gets back to this is a very sensitive area, so try to just keep the oil out of there.
As you know, Enbridge has been talking about a utility tunnel underground below the Straits of Mackinac. Would that fix it? Would that eliminate the threat to the Great Lakes?
From this particular site under the Straits, this isn't the first pipeline where someone has utilized a tunnel for a very sensitive pipeline route. The way the tunnel would work, if the pipeline were to fail, and it's not likely to in a tunnel.
Sure, it's not buffered like it was, yeah.
Yeah, you've got an air buffer between that and the soil, and so if it were to release, it's going to take the path of least resistance, and it's going to flow out towards the ends of the tunnel. And, you know, there are ways to protect that so it doesn't reach the sensitive waterways. So, yes, a tunnel is an excellent mechanism, but I got to be fair to Enbridge. It's not a cheap mechanism. All right.
Yeah,
that's
talking
a
about
big deal.
$500 million, I think.
Well, I don't know how accurate that number is, but yeah, it isn't cheap. I'll agree with that.
Still cheaper than a $2 billion cleanup.
Yes, it would be. Yes, it would be.
So the length of Line 5 in Michigan is entirely within the watershed of the Great Lakes, and it crosses the St. Clair River south of Lake Huron. It seems to me a leak anywhere is actually a Great Lakes leak because all the tributaries run to the Great Lakes. Is that as much of a problem as a leak in the Straits?
It's more of a risk because there's more miles of pipe that is closer to other waterways that are not as robust as the two pipelines underneath the straits. They're a whole different animal, different type of pipe, different thickness, different safety margins, all right? And you got less miles of it. But the point is there are risks to the onshore pipeline segments. How would you handle those, and how are you handling those? Because you've got more miles that could possibly fail and get oil into a sensitive water.
It's been 8 years, but everybody still remembers the Kalamazoo Enbridge pipeline spill pretty well, and that affected at least 35 miles of the river. And as you noted, there's probably some oil still left behind. What did it teach the company and the state of Michigan about the threats of these oil and gas pipelines?
In fairness, I've got to take a lot of the Enbridge officers at their word because they've been consistent. They truly saw it as a cultural learning curve that just totally surprised them, would be my observation of those people. And so if they've used it as a legitimate lessons learned and have adjusted their culture, that's a good thing, though it came at a tremendous price, tremendous cost.
Richard Kuperwitz is the president of the company AccuFacts Incorporated, and he's a pipeline safety consultant. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, and good day.
Enbridge declined to make someone available to discuss specifics about its insurance coverage in the event of an oil spill in the Straits of Mackinac, but did send a statement which reads in part, quote, "In the unlikely event of an emergency, we will not leave until the work is done. Enbridge has pledged to take full responsibility for the cleanup of any release in Michigan or anywhere along its pipeline system. The company's financial position and past follow-through on our commitment to Marshall, Michigan, support this pledge. Enbridge paid a full $1.2 billion cost of the July 2010 Marshall spill in Michigan on Line 6B, even though it exceeded insurance coverage." The statement goes on to say safety and prevention of a spill is the company's number one priority. Let's turn now to politics with our Friday commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. And Randy Richardville is president of R. James Consulting and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
I think we've all been watching developments in the race for governor, and I wanted to ask you both, what would you recommend to the Republican and Democratic candidates at this point? So, Vicki, let's start with you. Let's start with Bill Schuette, the Republican. What position or strategy is he doing right he should double down on?
I think that he's beginning to shift away from talking about a nationalized election and moving to state issues, and I think that's a good move on his part.
Randy, what do you think Schuette's getting right?
Well, I believe that the people in general are tired of politicians. I don't think that's a surprise. But I believe this is a battle for sincerity. Whichever of these two candidates comes out, and no matter what the position is, whether you're far right, far left, if people believe you're talking from your heart and you're being sincere, they're more likely to vote for you, even if they don't agree with every spot that you are, every position that you take. I think people are tired of these campaigns that paint people way off to one side or way off to the other side, or talk about lost decades or whatever it is that they're going to be speaking about. You need to talk to the people directly.
And you feel like Schuette's doing that?
I think Bill has the ability to do that. I don't think his campaign is necessarily doing that. They're talking about Jennifer Granholm and morphing her together with Gretchen Whitmer as if they are the same person, talking about how terrible life would be, et cetera, et cetera. I think that if Bill and his wife Cindy, who is an incredible person as well, if they talk to the people and say, these are our concerns. These are our genuine concerns. We're real people with real children, real life situations. Then I think they would do well.
Okay, let's look at what you think should be changed right now. Vicki, what do you think Schuette needs to stop doing or change or alter in his campaign?
Well, we talked about that a little bit. He needed to move more towards state issues. The problem is he's on the wrong side of those state issues. And that's where it's really going to be problematic for Bill Schuette. He has filed suit against LGBTQ community. He's opposed gay rights. He's opposed to anti-bullying measures that protect gay LGBTQ children. He has tried to redefine marriage again and filed suit against the Marriage Equality Act. He has not stated a position other than going against Obamacare on keeping expanded Medicaid, which guarantees health care for hundreds of thousands of people in the state of Michigan. And those are real problems. On the other hand, Gretchen has been very clear on her message. She has never nationalized.
We'll get to Gretchen in a second. Okay. I want to deal with this first. Okay, Randy, what do you think Schuette should change about his campaign right now?
I think he should talk about his record as Attorney General, because he is the only candidate that has actually run something. He's the only one that was in a majority. He's the only one that got bills passed and did work and accomplished things. So he should talk about what he did as the leader of the legal community in the state of Michigan as Attorney General. Gretchen is a great person and a great friend. She has never been in a position of leadership in terms of the majority. So she's always been in a minority position and hasn't had to run anything or get things done. So if I were Bill, I would be talking about, this is what I did as Attorney General, and I show these leadership skills to be things that can transcend into the governor's office as well.
All right, let's turn to Gretchen now. She's the Democrat running for governor. Vicki, what should Whitmer stick with in her campaign? What's she doing right?
She's concentrated on four major messages, and that is to fix the roads, protect and expand affordable and high-quality health care across the state of Michigan, improve education and training skills, and to clean up our drinking water, which is an expanding problem across the state. She's never varied from those messages. Those are her messages. I do pick a bone here with Randy's comment that she's never run anything or led. She was the minority leader of the Senate, and that is a very tough job when you are trying to protect your caucus and the issues for democratic values that you stand for. And she was able to negotiate many changes in terrible bills and to promote some very, very good bills, including expanded Medicaid. Shirky, who was one of the sponsors, was working with the governor on that, but it was left to Gretchen to shepherd that through the state Senate and to get it right and to get it done. And she did that from a very strong minority position. So to say she wasn't in charge of anything, it's more of a ludicrous statement than the actual truth.
Well, he did qualify it by saying she wasn't the leader of a majority. But we'll go on. Let's move on. Randy, what is Whitmer getting right in her campaign strategy or messaging?
Yeah, and with all due respect, when I was the leader of the Republican side of the Senate, I had 26 members and Gretchen had 12. So there was nothing that was going to get done when you needed 20 without the majority. It's not a shot at her. It's just a shot at the position. She did not lead those negotiations. And with all due respect, Vicki, I was in the room. You weren't. So I think
that's
I know
true.
What I'm talking about. So,
all right. Let's get back to the topic. The topic at hand is whether Whitmer's campaign is doing something right or not. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Gretchen's an incredible person as far as reaching through the television screen. She has a good persona. She has a good sense of humor. She's the kind of person you wouldn't mind having a beer with after work. Like I said before, people are looking for sincerity, looking for real people. And I might disagree with her, but she is a real person. She is a person that's easy to talk to and you like to be around. You know, we've been friends for close to 20 years, and I consider us to be very good friends, even though we disagree on a number of issues. But I think that's what she's doing right.
Vicki, in these last 6 weeks of the campaign, what does Whitmer need to change?
I think there's a problem that both candidates are going to have, and that is turnout, especially with the no straight party ticket voting this year. I haven't seen any effort to ramp up the number of ballot posts in precincts. I haven't seen any plans to spend the appropriated money that the legislature put in the bill to make sure that people's votes are counted and that they can get through the lines very quickly. Gretchen comes at this election in a very strong position with the Me Too movement very active, with a strong following of not only Democrats, but a new group of Republicans for Gretchen Whitmer, and the strong feeling for people that really want, as Randy said, somebody real and that they can relate to, and that is Gretchen.
Randy, what does Whitmer need to stop doing or change in these last weeks of the campaign?
Well, yeah, I said this to the New York Times the other day, and Gretchen and I actually talked about it a little bit. I said that she is a lot more liberal than what most people know. I mean, a lot more liberal. But what's going to happen is 99% the state Senate is going to stay Republican, and she is going to have to decide whether she wants to be, quote-unquote, Jennifer Granholm-ish, or whether she wants to be Bill Clinton-ish and get things done. So we can either go to stalemate or we can say we're going to work together on this. If she's elected governor, she hasn't had a history of that because she has been the spokesperson for the Democrats saying Rick Snyder this, Rick Snyder that, Donald Trump this or whatever. And so she hasn't been forced to work together with the other side. If she decides to do that and develops a skill set to work with the other side, she could be a very successful governor. But I think she has to get that message across. And, well, that's what I think.
Randy Richardville is a former Republican legislator. Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic legislator. Hey, I hope you both enjoy the first weekend of autumn.
Thank
so
you. What a beautiful September so far, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is.
All right, thanks.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
That is Stateside for today. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.